相当于配那个调味的，但是那个鸡肉味特别辣。
Okay, so let's get started. You recording? Paul, you are? Okay. Okay, so why don't we get started? Just quick question, is there any issue with the programming assignment that you want to bring up? I have not heard from anyone, so I'm presuming that you all have looked at it, understood it, and have gotten started on it. Okay, if there are any questions, you should ask either now or you could always send email. Alright? Okay, so quick recap of what we did last time. We did look at lightweight RPCs and we spent some time looking at remote method invocations, which is how the concept of RPC is implemented in an object-oriented world. So today we are going to look at two issues. One is message-oriented communication and various dimensions that you use to design a system where two parties can communicate or two processes can communicate. And the two dimensions we'll look at in particular are persistence, persistent versus transient communication, and synchronous versus asynchronous communication. And then we'll spend some time looking at stream-oriented communication, which is what is used in video and audio streaming. Okay, so to understand persistence and synchronicity, we have to keep some picture in mind, and this is the thing to keep in mind. There are two endpoints, a sender and a receiver. Okay, that are trying to communicate over a network, and any message that is sent by the sender to the receiver is assumed to go over some number of hops or some number of intermediate routers that are shown in this picture, and this could the network that sits between the sender or the receiver is not important here. It could either be a local area or a wide area network. Okay, so what is important is what is the semantics that the sender and the receiver agree on in order to communicate with one another. Okay. So the first dimension is persistence versus transient communication. So in persistent communication, essentially messages are sent one hop at a time, and they are stored at each hop until the next hop becomes ready to receive this. So here is an example of not a distributed system, but just a simple example of the pony delivering mail using the pony post office. And what's done is from each hop you take mail and you take it to the next hop, you store it there, you resort it, and then there's another pony that takes it to the next hop, and so on until mail is delivered to each recipient. Okay? So this is store and forward communication. Okay, that's the thing to keep in mind. Email is an example of persistent communication, as we will see in a moment. Okay. Now the other side of this is transient communication, and this is the exact opposite. And here we assume that both the sender and the receiver have to be executing in order to communicate. In other words, mail messages are not stored for long periods of time. They are only stored so long as both parties are communicating. Okay? If you cannot deliver the message to either the next hop or to the sender, you discard it immediately. You don't store it. Yeah, like in the previous case, you will store it until the next hop becomes ready. That's not the case here. Okay? TCP assumes this model, obviously, because this is a transient communication model. You assume that both the endpoints are live or alive. And if one of them goes down, you just tear down the connection and messages are discarded. Okay? So again, in a typical network router, when you do routing, you will discard the message if you cannot deliver it to the next hop, for example, okay, and send back an error. Okay, and we'll come back to examples of all of this in just a moment. Let's just go through the various dimensions. So the other side of this is whether communication, okay, this is now a different dimension, whether communication is synchronous or asynchronous. Okay? You know what synchronous communication is. This is just the standard blocking mode of communication. Okay, you send a message and you block until something happens. And the something is basically either the message is copied over to the local buffer, copied over to the remote buffer, or deliver to the destination. You can block for any of these events to happen. But you are going to block until something has happened, and only then will you continue execution. As opposed to this, if you do use asynchronous communication, the sender is basically just going to send the message and continue execution. You are not after you submit the message. Okay, so you typically only copy it to some local buffer and continue. You are not going to wait until it's received at the other end. So now let's look at combinations of this, and that's really what is important from our perspective. How can you, so depending on whether you use persistent or transient, and synchronous and asynchronous, you will get many combinations. Okay? And each combination maps to something you probably know already, okay, a model that we know already. So the first one that is shown here is persistent and asynchronous communication. Okay, so here, since it's persistent, it's store and forward. Okay, it means that the receiver doesn't have to be executing, for example. Okay, so and it's asynchronous, so this is non-blocking model. Okay, so here is A just basically sends the message and continues execution. Okay, and the message then makes its way to the receiver. Okay, and the receiver is not executing when this message was sent, and at some later point in time, the receiver takes delivery of this message. So you have persistent because the store message is stored until the receiver runs, and it's asynchronous because the sender is not blocked. Okay? Email is an example of this. Obviously, you can send a message and then you continue doing something else. There's no guarantee when if your client says message or send, doesn't mean that it has reached the other end. It just means that you sent it and you handed it over to the mail system. Okay? Any questions here? Is this clear? So the next model is persistent and synchronous. Okay, so now we still have persistent communication, okay, which means that these are store and forward, but this is synchronous. Okay, so in this case, what will happen is you send the message, but since you're synchronous, you're going to block, okay, and until you get back an acknowledgement saying message has reached the other end, okay, and then you will continue. Now, since you have persistent communication, this message is going to be buffered. It's going to be stored there until the receiver actually starts running and takes delivery of the message. So here is where you actually take delivery of this message at some later point in time, and then you process that message. Okay, so this is persistent synchronous. Okay, now you come to the other two. So first one is transient and asynchronous. Okay, so transient basically means message is not going to be stored. Both parties have to be executing, which is what is shown in this picture. And asynchronous means that the sender is not going to block. Yeah, so here is basically a case where the A is executing. It just sends the message. Since it's asynchronous, it's non-blocking. You just continue. Okay? And message is now reaches the other end. And since you are doing transient, it's not going to be stored. So if you in the normal case, B has to be running and it takes delivery of the message. Okay? Example of this is UDP communication. Yeah, so transient asynchronous. Now in the transient synchronous case, we'll have three flavors. Okay, they're all transient synchronous, but depending on what the exact semantics are, you get three variants. Okay. Again, transient means not message is not going to be stored, so both parties have to be executing, but now you have synchronous, so the sender is going to block, okay, until an acknowledgement is received. Now, depending on what the acknowledgement indicates to the sender, we get these three flavors. Okay? If the acknowledgement just says that the message has reached the other machine, okay, this is called receipt-based. If the acknowledgement says it has not only reached the other machine, it has been delivered to the application that you are communicating with, that will be called delivery-based. And the last one is it's not only delivered but also processed. Okay, so we'll look at the three flavors. So this one is receipt-based. It just says that a message has reached the other end. So it's blocking. So A executes, sends a message, blocks. The message reaches the other end. ACK comes back. Okay, and then it continues. So ACK tells A that the message was received by machine B. Okay. Now since the other end can actually take delivery of that message a little later. Okay, but it's not stored until a long period of time. So you're assuming that B is still running. In other words, process B is alive, but it's just doing something else. It just takes delivery a little later to process the request.
But the message should be stored in a server side, yes.
Yes, but it will be stored in this case. The example thing to keep in mind is it is stored in the socket buffer. Okay, meaning that the socket buffer will be torn down if B is not running, for example. Okay, so that's just a local buffer. It's not long-term storage. Unlike email, you may not be logged in. You could come back 10 days later to read your email. That's a long-term storage. Here, you're just assuming that process B is executing and will take delivery soon. Okay. Now, delivery-based model is the same thing, except that the acknowledgement is delayed until B actually takes delivery. B reads from the socket buffer and takes delivery. At this point, ACK goes back saying message has not only reached machine B, but the process that you send the message has actually accepted the message. Okay? The last case is not only does that process accept the message, you wait for it to process it and then you send the acknowledgement. And this is basically the RPC model, obviously, because you send a request, you wait for a response. Okay, and the response requires that the message should have been processed. The previous one is asynchronous RPC. Okay, so all of these dimensions actually map to things that we have looked at, email or asynchronous RPC, UDP or standard RPC. Any questions here? Okay, so the last three that we talked about, okay, so receipt based, delivery based, and response based, map directly to these primitives that MPI supports that we talked towards the end of last class. So I'll talk about that again. So remember that MPI is this library that allows very efficient message passing. MPI stands for message passing interface, and it has three variants of send. Okay, the send until you wait until you copy it to the remote buffer. S send is wait until receipt starts, and send receive is wait for a reply. Okay, so these three directly map to these model that we talked about for transient synchronous. Okay, so last one is response based, delivery based, and the receipt based. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. Okay, so now let's go into a little more detail into persistent communication. Okay, transient communication you probably know already. This is simple socket communication, or you use RPCs, because both parties have to be executing. Okay? Now, persistent communication uses a different model. This is a store and forward paradigm. And typically, you probably haven't seen a system that actually supports persistent communication. Email is an application that supports persistent communication, but it's not a system that enables other applications to be written that employ persistent communication. Okay. Now, there are many systems that have been built that support this, and they all fall into this category of message queuing systems. Okay. So what happens in all of these is there is this notion of a queue, and when you send a message, the message gets appended to this queue. Okay. And this queue is basically a long-term storage somewhere in the network. Okay. And the receiver then has to read from the queue in order to take delivery of the message. Okay. In case of email as your application, inbox is this queue or the buffer. Okay. Messages get appended to this queue, and then your mail client is going to take delivery. But this notion is generalized, and you have this general notion of a queue, and you can then layer any application you want on top of this. Okay. Queues can be named, so there will be multiple queues. Each application can use one or more, and you can determine, depending on who you are communicating with, which queue you want to append your message to, and so on. Okay. So there's this bunch of systems called MQS, and we'll look at several examples in just a moment. So you communicate by inserting messages in the queue, and when you insert a message, the only thing that the sender is guaranteed that it has actually gotten into the recipient's queue. Okay, you cannot guarantee that the recipient will even take delivery of the message. That you cannot say, because the other end is not even executing. Okay, this is just the same as email. All you can do is send an email, and some you probably know that it has been delivered if it doesn't bounce, but that doesn't tell you whether the other party has read it. Okay, that you cannot be guaranteed. Same is true in message queuing system. No, this one seems to work. Okay, so I think there will be. Let me see. Oh, figure is a black box. That's not good. There will be several slides where I have to draw this. Okay, that's fine. compatibility problems. Okay, so I know what this figure is. I can just draw this. So message queuing systems basically have, this is the sender, this is your queue, and this is the receiver. Okay. And in this kind of communication, there are four flavors. Okay. One is the queue is always assumed to exist once you set it up. Okay. The sender could be executing, but the receiver is dormant or not even running at this point. So only the sender is running and it appends a message in the queue. Let's say at some later point in time, the receiver is taking delivery of this message, and no assumption is made about what is happening to the sender at that point. So the sender may not be running. Okay, so sender may have even terminated, but the receiver goes to the queue and takes delivery in the message. Okay. Now there's also a scenario where neither the sender is running nor the receiver is running, and the message is just sitting in a queue. Okay, so neither of these two run, and the message just sits in the queue until the receiver starts running at some later point in time. Okay, so in this case, communication is enabled in any combination of the scenario: sender running, receiver running, sender running, receiver not running, sender not running, receiver running, or neither of them run. Okay, but you can still communicate. Is that clear? Okay. So here are the primitives that any message queuing system will support for us. Okay, so one is the standard one which you use to append to a queue is called put. Okay, this just allows you to append a message to a specified queue. Okay, here is the queue that we see here. Okay, so this is the queuing layer. This is a persistent queue, which means that regardless of whether the sender runs or not, the queue is still there and it stores all unreceived messages. Okay, so when you do a put, the message queuing system will take that, deliver that message to that queue, and then store it there. Okay. Now, as far as the receiver is concerned, it has three options to take delivery of this message at some later point in time. Okay. One is a blocking option, which just says get message. Okay, so if you just do a get on the queue, you will block until there is a message in the queue. If there's a message is already queued up, you will just get the first message. Okay. Otherwise, if the queue is empty, get will block until a message arrives, and then it will return with a message. Okay. Now, if you don't want to write the receiver such that it blocks or uses synchronous reads from the queue, you have the other option, which is you can poll the queue to see if is there a message. Okay. So this just tells you the status of the queue. It will just look at the queue and say is the queue empty or not. Okay. So you could just poll, and if the queue is not empty, can you do a get? In this case, you will not block for a long period of time if the queue was empty. Okay. And the other way to do this is you basically just install a handler, which is and use a notify call, which says if a message arrives, just notify me. Okay. In this case, whenever the message arrives, there is a signal, and then you can read that and in your data.
So what are the basic socket and mechanism we are using queuing?
What's the question?
Basic socket. Right. Queuing mechanism.
Will the basic sockets use queuing mechanism? So sockets, the picture is actually similar, looks similar, but the semantics are very different. Okay, in the socket world, what happens is, first of all, this is transient communication, not persistent. Okay, so let's say this is sender, receiver, this OS here, sender is a process running here, receiver is a process running here. There's a buffer here, which is your socket buffer. Okay, it's usually 64 kilobytes or some small number of kilobytes. So when you send a message, it actually goes and sits here. Okay, receiver can take delivery at some later point in time, but this queue is associated with the receiver. If the receiver is not running, okay, the queue is toned down, meaning then the communication cannot happen. No, data will not overflow. The socket connection is torn down, so you cannot even send. If you try to write to the socket, you'll get an error here. Okay. In this case, the queue is persistent. It's actually a file on disk. This is a memory buffer. Okay. In a message queuing system, all queues are disk queues because they are persistent. They have to stay for long periods of time. So it's really not a memory buffer, but it's a disk file. And then this send will essentially stick your message into that file, and then when this reads, the message queuing system will take the message out of the file and give it. Okay, is that clear? Okay. So this is small problem here.
Maybe you can check the PDF files on the website.
That's a good point. That's what I'm doing. Seems to be a large file. Okay. So here is your, okay, so this is the slide I wanted to show. Is this visible?
Yes.
Okay. Alright. So now in a general message queuing system, in the simple case I just said there's a queue, so there's one sender, one receiver, and there's a queue at the receiver. But in a typical distributed application, there may be lots of senders and lots of receivers, and they're all communicating with one another. So what is done typically is that you have a more general architecture where there are queue managers and there are relays. Okay, so queue managers sit at the endpoint, they manage queues. So here is your send queue and here is a receive queue. And then they talk to the relays and relays keep forwarding this until the message actually reaches a queue at the destination. And each of these intermediate queues is also using a store and forward paradigm, meaning that they're persistent. So if a message, let's say, has to go from sender A via these two relays, relays are similar to a router, to this application, and each of these queues is also a store and forward queue, which means if this relay is not running for any reason, this queue here is going to buffer it until this comes up and then sends it and so on. Okay, so this is how larger message queuing systems are built. They don't just assume so that there is just a sender and a receiver and there are only queues at the two endpoints. You will have these intermediaries and so on. And the nice thing about this is this separates knowledge of the network topology from queue management. Okay, it's the relays that need to decide how to route all of your messages to the endpoint. Okay, so the relays can reside on routers, for example, and they have knowledge of the network topology, they know how to route and whatnot. And at the endpoints, you don't need to worry about it. You just manage your local queues. Okay, so if there's an outgoing queue, you just tell the relay saying, just take the messages and you figure out how to route it and just send it off to the destination. Okay, so this allows also some separations of concerns. Otherwise, each of these senders would have to have some notion of network topology to figure out how to send, route the message to the network and so on. Okay, very similar to what is done in networks as well. I mean, this is how TCP or UDP would route messages. You just hand the message to your edge router and it decides how to send it. Okay, the endpoints don't have to worry about routing. The same is true in message queuing systems as well. Okay. Now there's one more entity that is present in most message queuing systems, and these are called message brokers. And so think of this as application level gateways that sit between a sender and a receiver. Okay. So there could be these dotted lines indicate there could be multiple relays in between. Okay. And what this broker is doing is it's just doing simple translation. Okay. So the notion of a broker is used to translate messages from one format to another. This allows application endpoints to communicate even if they speak slightly different protocols. Okay, so the broker has a repository with conversion rules, and whenever a message comes in, it looks at the destination and says the destination can speak this language and you'll just translate the message into this form. Okay, so if you think about streaming, for example. Okay, so if you had put a message broker that is transparently doing this translation, then you could use a client that, let's say, supports Windows Media, and I mean, it can access a file or a server that sends QuickTime, and there is something in between that's translating QuickTime into Windows Media commands and back and forth. It just as an example. So that's what message brokers use. And then the reason they are there is in large systems, there are lots of senders and lots of receivers. If you add a new application, okay, so all you have to do is to add some conversion rules. And if this application speaks a different protocol, you just add some rules here which allow you to just translate messages from one format to another. Okay, so it's just doing message translation. That's why it's called a broker. Okay, so the last thing here is case study of IBM's RESQ MQ. So this is IBM's message queuing system. Okay, Microsoft has one, and there are other companies that also have similar things. And the architecture looks more complex than it is. So this is used mainly in enterprises to build large distributed applications. Okay, so you use this message queuing system to have persistent stores, you send messages. And so if you think of financial application, right, so there are let's take stock trading, right, as a concrete example. So if you want to build stock trading using a queuing system like this, so the thing to keep in mind is that there are any stock trade and any online stock trade that is placed goes through a sequence of processing steps. Okay, each processing step, let's say, is a machine that's a component of the application. So it's similar to a multi-tier application. Okay, this is where you place the trade, and it maybe it'll go and check whether you have authority to place this trade, whether you have enough account balance to place this trade in your stock trading account, and then it'll go and figure out which exchange to send it to, who has the best price. It'll get some bids, and then it'll route it to the right exchange and execute your trade. So there are these sequence of steps, and so there are all these orders flowing into your system, okay, from customers. So what would happen is you could probably put all of these into a message queuing system, because you have to process them in some order in which they came in. Okay? And then the first step, first component would read it, it would do some processing, and it would generate additional messages that would go on to the next step and so on. And these orders would flow through the system, okay, until each of these trades is executed. This is just an example of how you may use a message queuing system, because at each step you have to buffer all of the pending requests, and you could use the notion of queues to do that. Okay. Now there are several components here. So the two things that are most important, and the rest of it is all not very interesting, is that the queue manager, and there is a notion of a message channel. Okay. So this is how you separate. In the previous slide I talked about queue manager doing local queue management, and these relays think about routing and so on, and this is the same type of separation of concerns. The queue manager is just looking at local queues and trying to append messages into queue or take delivery of messages into queues, and these message channels are essentially the transport protocols. Okay, so what the message channel would do is it would set up socket connections, it would send of TCP messages and get acknowledgements and all of that. So this is doing the networking, and this is just doing the local buffer management, is the way to think about this. Okay, so you'll also see that there are stubs at each end. Okay, and that the reason for that is the interface to the MQS is an RPC like interface, and that's the reason you see those stubs. So you can make RPC calls and do these gets and puts as a remote procedure. Okay, because this machine may be different from that machine, so you have to send the message from here to here. Okay, is this clear how this works? Okay. Now we will switch gears and start talking about stream-oriented communication. Okay, so until now we have slowly focused on message-oriented communication, which is request-reply or client-server type models. Stream-oriented communication is a different way in which two endpoints can communicate, and this is mainly used for audio and video. Although there are other types of data that continuously streams over a network and is processed, okay, and they would also use the notion of stream-oriented communication. Okay, so in this lecture, we are only going to focus on audio and video, and not other forms of streaming data. Okay, so we'll refer to audio and video collectively as continuous media, and the reason for this is the way this media is delivered to clients is that the server continuously streams data over a network, and it arrives at the client. The client takes delivery and plays it out. Okay, so the data is just streaming over the network, and this is why this is called stream-oriented communication. Okay. The most important issue in continuous media communication is timing. Okay, so data is, or this is also referred to as isochronous communication, and the reason for this is that if timing guarantees are not met, okay, application does not function correctly. Okay. In message-oriented communication, we did not think about timing. There was no notion of the delay that is incurred from between sending a message and delivery of the message. Okay, we assumed a best effort paradigm. It just says you may do your best to deliver the message as fast as possible, but there are no guarantees. Okay. In this case, without some notion of end-to-end bounds on delays, okay, your application is not going to function correctly. And the reason for this is very simple. Let's take video as a concrete example. So if you take high quality or DVD quality video that uses a frame rate of 30 frames a second, which means that every 33 milliseconds we just display a new image. Okay, and that's how video playback proceeds. Now if you don't get the next frame in time, this means every 33 milliseconds you need to get a frame. Okay, if you don't get it in time, your playback is going to freeze. Okay, because you don't have data to display. And then you are going to drop some frames and then you move on. Now from a user standpoint, that is not an appealing thing, because you are watching a video, you don't want your video to freeze or audio to suddenly stop and then it just starts again. Okay? You do see this if you use any satellite or digital cable. Occasionally there are errors and you will see some glitches. Okay? This is called a playback glitch. The same is true if you have streamed anything over a network, you probably see that, since the internet uses a best effort paradigm, if your client does not do a good job, you will see these freezes happening. Okay? So you don't want that. So the question is, what would you have to do from a communication standpoint to reduce these problems? Okay? So that's one important issue in stream-oriented communication. The other important issue, or the other thing that distinguishes this from message-oriented communication, is that you use the push mode. Okay, in the message-oriented communication, you typically employ request-reply paradigm, which is pull. You make a request and you get some data. Okay? So this is all push mode. So what you do is you just you use your media client and you just say play. Okay? Your media client just sends a play request to the server. Beyond this point, the client is not saying give me more data or give me the next frame. None of that happens. The server just starts pushing data, just streaming data to you until you say stop or something like that, or you quit your client. Okay? So this is push mode of communication, which is different. Okay? Which means you don't explicitly request data. Data is sent to you from the server. Okay, so here is a picture of two common modes of communication. Okay, so the first one is single sender, single receiver. Okay, this is fairly common if you are doing video conferencing. Okay, or you are using any chat program that can do conferencing, and you just have two endpoints. There is a camera here, there is a display there. The camera is just taking images and probably also capturing audio, sending it over the network, and is displayed at the other end. Okay, this is also called live communication, because whatever is captured at one end is sent live over a network and displayed at the other end. Okay. You could also have one single sender, single receiver in case of what's called stored communication. And there you don't have a camera, you just have a media server. Okay, that just has some video clips or some files that are stored on disk. And the client in this case just says play, and then the server just retrieves data from disk and streams it. In either case, data is streaming over the network. In one case, the data that's coming to you is live, in another case it's stored. But in both scenarios, you have one sender and one receiver. You could also have scenarios where you have one sender, multiple receivers. Okay, so there's one sender, and there are a whole bunch of these receivers. So live webcast is an example of single sender, multiple receivers. Okay, there's a webcast, which is a source that's just sending out data. You can join the webcast. There are probably many parties that are watching this webcast live over the internet, for instance. And the data has to be then sent to all of them. Okay, and here what we have shown is a multicast tree that has been constructed. So the source just sends it the data of the data that's being webcast to the root of the tree. Each of these nodes then sends it down the tree, and then the sinks are all the receivers. Okay, so the data just trickles or streams over this each of these paths along the tree and hits a receiver. Okay, this is multicast mode of communication, which we'll come to also. move it. So first let's talk about this notion of how to meet these time guarantees. And the way this is typically done is that the sender and the receiver first specifies what is called a quality of service. And this is the quality that you want to desire from your connection in order to get good playback quality. Okay? So quality of service has many dimensions. Okay? These are just a few that are shown here. Typically, so let me just, before we go into the details here. So here is a simpler notion of what a quality of service is. So suppose you are a client and you are trying to get a video clip from the server. What are the things you would specify? Okay, you can specify the bandwidth that you have. So you can say I'm on a dial-up line, or I am on a cable modem from home, or I'm on a LAN from my work environment. So that's one thing. Okay, that says this is the bandwidth I can receive at. The other thing you can say is your screen size. Okay, am I trying to make this request over my small phone, or do I have a laptop, or do I have a large desktop screen? Okay, this can depending on this, the server can send you data at an appropriate quality. Okay, if you are viewing this video, okay, let's say it's a YouTube video on a small screen, okay, there's no reason to send high bandwidth version of this video to you, because everything you're going to see is on a fairly small screen. On the other hand, if you're watching this on a large display, the server can actually send you a higher bandwidth version of the same video. Okay, so you can specify lots of these parameters. And then you also specify some network level parameters, which is things like the bit rate, I already mentioned, the maximum delay, the end-to-end delay, the jitter, the round-trip delay, and we'll come to some of this in a moment. So based on these parameters, the client and the server have to then agree that you can send data and receive data that meets these requirements. Okay, this is just a requirement on the connection. This is what you are desiring from your network connection. Going back. So there has been a lot of research that has gone on to what are the right things to specify as part of your quality of service request. Okay. Here are just a few things that I mentioned. Okay, so you can things like loss interval, loss sensitivity. You have to assume that there will be some loss. So even that you can specify, saying that occasionally I'm willing to put up with a glitch, but I don't want a glitch more than once a minute or once an hour. This could be a specification. And then the network has to guarantee you that quality. Okay, if it doesn't, then it has violated the QoS requirement. Okay. And then there are other things like token bucket, which I'll talk about in a slide. Okay, so initially when you set up the connection, you specify the quality of service. And then we look at various ways to enforce it. Okay, so here is one way to specify it, which is called a token bucket. Okay. Token bucket, this is a specification that just looks at the rate at which you are going to send data. Okay, the other things like delay, etc., is not part of this specification. This is just a specification of the rate. And the basic example of what a token bucket is and how it works is as follows. So the token bucket says that you are allowed to send data at a rate R, and an average rate R, and you are allowed to have a burst, instantaneous burst of B. Okay, so this is a pair that you specify. And what this means is at any given time, point in time, let's say T, the amount of data that you send cannot exceed this value. Okay, this is the average rate and this is the burst. So just to draw a picture, the rate, so here is, this is time, this is data sent. So if you actually want to meet this token bucket specification, the amount of data that you could send at any time t is bounded by the curve r times t plus b. Okay, because the average rate at which you can send is r, so the data can only, your curve can only go up at with a slope of r, and this is the burst b. Okay. So you can always send, what you actually send may be something that is either hugs this line or is somewhere below, but it can never exceed it. And this is sort of bounding the rate at which you can send. Now, why is this called a token bucket? the way it is actually implemented is best understood as a bucket, which is actually shown in this picture. So assume that every packet that is sent out requires a token. Okay, if it gets a token, then it gets to go out. If there is no token, it has to wait until a token is generated. Okay, and you have a, you are given a bucket of tokens, and this bucket you start off, you initialize this bucket with B tokens. Okay, and you generate a token at a rate of R every second. Okay, that's your average rate. So if your bucket is not full, then you will generate a token at a rate of R and you will start filling the bucket. Once it becomes full, then if you generate more tokens, you just discard them. Okay? So what does this mean? At any point in time, your bucket has up to B token. That's the size of the bucket. It cannot hold more than B. Okay? So this means instantaneously you can send B packets into the network. This is your burst of B. Okay, burst just says I just sent a whole bunch of packets all at the same. So the maximum burst size is B. Since you have B tokens to start with, if your bucket is full, I can just send blast B packets into the network without having them wait. Okay, but once I do that, my bucket becomes empty. Okay, if I just use up my entire burst, bucket is empty. At this point in time, every packet will go out at the rate of every 1/r second. Okay, because every packet will wait here until the next token is generated and keep going. Okay, so in other words, that's the same curve that we talked about here. So you are basically regulating the rate at which you send data into the network using this specification or this equation. Okay. So the operating system, what it would do is it would basically associate this token bucket with the socket. Okay, and the token bucket would have these tokens. And every time you try to send on the socket, before it actually sends it over the network, it will try to get a token from this bucket. Okay, and the bucket is really a variable counter. Okay, it's not really a bucket in the kernel, but it's a counter. So that counter can never exceed, have a value of greater than B. Okay, and the counter is incremented by 1 every 1/r seconds. That's the way it works. Is this clear? What a token bucket does? Any questions here? Okay, so the other thing I should mention is the amount of data you can send in any interval delta t. Okay, what would that be? Based if you specify a token bucket and you adhere to this token bucket specification, I said that if you start from 0 at any time t, this is the amount of data you could have sent. But if you look at any time interval in between, let's say t1, t2. Which we'll call delta t. Okay. What is this value? It has to be r. Okay. In other words, actually it has to be r times delta t plus b. This is the maximum amount of data you can send in any interval also, because you could send a maximum burst and then you just send at the rate. Or you could have several small bursts that add up to B, but you send at the average rate. Okay, so that it all not only bounds the total you sent over from the very beginning, it also bounds the amount of data you can send over any interval as well. Okay, by the same equation.
Actually, the role of a token bucket is just to control a flow.
What is the what?
Target.
Target. Yes. Target is to control the rate at which you are sending. Yes. So this basically prevents you from sending at very high rates, so you actually only send at the rate specified by the token bucket. Okay, so it has an average rate and it has a burst. So you can send a little more than your average every once in a while by bursting, but you can't send more than R at the average rate of R. Okay, so now how is all this enforced? So this is so you specify a quality of service. You may have even specified a token bucket, but at the end of the day, you want a connection that is going to meet your quality of service guarantees. Okay. So, since this data typically goes over the internet, and the internet itself does not have any real support for quality of service. Yeah, the internet uses a best effort paradigm. If you write on a socket and it goes to a router doesn't guarantee you anything. Okay, in terms of delay or latency or drop rate or anything like that. So you have to basically come up with techniques to actually enforce this quality of service guarantee or provide this quality of service guarantee. So rates can be regulated at the endpoints. Okay? So you don't need any support from the network in order to regulate the rate. You just put a token bucket at the server and you just have a recipient there. So the token bucket just guarantees the rate at which the server is sending data. So if rate is the only thing you care about from your quality of service, that is easy to handle. It does not need network support. It only needs endpoint support. But if you want other things, like you want to guarantee a loss rate, okay, you will say that I don't want more than 10 packets to be dropped every second. You could specify a quality of service in this fashion. This requires network support. Yeah, because right now, if the network is not going to give you any guarantees, it could drop arbitrary number of packets. So you may specify some QoS in terms of loss rate, but a network cannot guarantee you that, because it has no notion of what you need. It is trying to do its best, but it cannot guarantee anything. So if you want to do this kind of QoS, you actually require support in the network. And there has been, again, a lot of work that people did in order to change the internet model to add quality of service inside the network. Okay. It turns out that none of that succeeded, which is why you don't see any of that out there. But there is a large body of work as to how you could do this, how you could add support at the routers in order to do this. So what you do is you actually mark packets with flows, and then the routers keep state saying how many packets have I dropped, what does the quality, what QoS does this flow need. And if you have some leeway, you can drop more packets. If you don't, you continue to forward packets. And the reason is, since the routers now have to keep state, this limits scalability. Okay? Typical routers that are in the core of the network will carry hundreds of thousands of flow at any given time. If you have to keep track of the quality of service for each of this flow, the amount of memory that you have to have on these routers and all of the computations you have to do just go blows up. Okay, and that doesn't allow you to scale your routers to very high speed backbone. And this is the primary reason why this research actually never succeeded. The techniques are out there, but they are not implemented, okay, in any commercial or system. Okay. So network support is more or less out. Okay, the only thing you can do is put support at the endpoints in order to specify your QoS. So you could do things like token bucket to regulate the rate, and then you have to put buffers at the receiver in order to mask jitter. Okay, so that's what we look at. So to understand what jitter is, so this is a picture that shows you what's going on. So let's suppose that the server is sending data periodically in a nice fashion. Okay, so here is the departure at the source, departure of packets at the server. So you are sending data periodically. But as the data enters the network, okay, since there are queuing delays that at routers and so on, by the time the data actually gets to the destination, there may be additional gaps that have gotten introduced. Okay? Because this packet came on time, but then the next packet got queued up at some buffer in the router because it was congested, and that added some delay. So by the time this came, there was a big gap, and then there was another gap, and then the next two packets came immediately after three and so on. Okay, so even though you may send periodically, there's no guarantee that you are going to receive at the same rate. Okay. So there is going to be jitter in the receive. The jitter just says that the inter-packet gap will keep fluctuating depending on what happened in the network, present network condition. Now, if you just start playing this data out, okay, the client is going to see lots of problems, because you display the first frame. Let's say you send one frame of packet and there is a gap, then you wait. Okay, and then this frame shows up, and then you wait again, and then these three frames come one after another, and you can display. So there is going to be jerky playback. So you can't do that, obviously. So what you do is that the client is going to buffer data and hold data in the buffer and then play out. Okay? So the buffer allows you to mask the jitter. Yeah, because what's happening is data is entering the buffer with jitter, but you are pulling data out periodically. Okay, so if you actually have, in this case, what is shown is the buffer is 6 packets. Okay, so you don't start playback when the first packet arrives. You wait until some number of packets arrive. They're all buffered, and then you start playing them out. So at this point, you have 6 packets. Okay, so you start playing them out at the same rate at the sender sent. Okay, so this, let's say, is 30 frames a second or 30 packets a second. So you keep playing out. But now, if there is a large gap between a packet, your buffer is draining, but it's not filling at the same rate. So eventually, you will have buffer underflow, which means you have drained all the packets from your buffer, but no additional packets have arrived. So that's what is shown here. So 6 came, and then 7 came after a long time, but by the time, and then 8 also came after a long time. So by the time you played out 7, your buffer emptied. and 8 hasn't even come in by this point in time. Yeah, because 8, so you have 7 and 8 hasn't arrived. So you will have a playback glitch here. Okay? So what this says is the size of the buffer that you put is going to be important. If you have small buffers, you can start playback faster. Okay, if you just had a buffer of 3, you could start playback at this point, at time 6 seconds. Okay? But the probability of the buffer getting emptied and seeing a playback glitch goes up. But if you have a large buffer, then you reduce that probability because you're masking jitter by keeping more and more data to play out. Okay? But then that increases playback latency. You have to wait for a long period of time. Okay? So if you actually use any of these media players like Real or Windows Media or QuickTime, you'll see that when you start playback, it will start saying a buffering. This is effectively what is data started coming, but it's not playing it out because it wants to mask all of these problems from it. And most of these will actually adaptively choose buffers sizes based on the quality it is sensing. Okay, if it starts seeing that data rate has dropped, it may give you a glitch, but then it increases the size of the buffer so that from this point on things are better. So you start adjusting this dynamically. Okay, so there are techniques like that are used in media players. How do you compute the size of the buffer?
No, the time
is the same as the amount of data you buffer in this case, right? So it's not really time, but the data that you store, that you basically. So in this case, you say I'm going to wait for the first 6 packets to arrive, and then I'm going to start playback. And the time can vary depending on how quickly they arrive or how slowly they arrive. Okay. So a buffer sizes are chosen based on the amount of data or packets or frames you buffer, not the time, typically. Okay, now the question is still relevant, how do you choose that size of the buffer? And that has to depend on network condition. The more the jitter, more the loss, the larger your buffer has to be to mask this problem. And the better the network quality, smaller the buffer can be. You know, again, there's been a lot of research. There's no simple equation there, but there are lots of techniques people have come up with. Okay, so this is one problem, how to mask jitter. Okay, the next problem is how do you mask, or not mask, but reduce the impact of losses. Okay, so the two things can happen when data goes over a network. One is there are queues build up in routers that increases the delay and jitter. The other thing is if queues build up to a point, then the router will start dropping packets. In this case, you get loss, okay, because the router is congested, so data just disappear. So what sent will not be received? So here is an example. So let's suppose that the server is just sending these packets, okay, or rather these frames. So you have, in this case, this is a made-up example. So you have 4 frames in the first packet, 4 frames in the second packet. Typically, you can't put a frame in a packet, but just for simplicity, let's assume you can put 4 frames in the first packet, second packet, and so on. Okay? Now, at the receiver, we'll assume that the first and the second packets are received, but the third packet is lost in the network. It's never received. Okay? So what will happen is when you start playing this out, you'll play out assuming you buffer and so on. You'll first 8 frames will play out well, and then you will have a gap because the next 4 frames have disappeared. Okay, so you'll just have this playback glitch, and playback will resume starting from frame 30. Okay, now depending on how many frames are lost, this gap or glitch that you see will be either large or small. Okay, but you will see this noticeable gap in playback. Now, what can you do to minimize the impact of this? Okay. Retransmissions is not an option. Okay. Unlike TCP, which will say, I lost this packet, can you retransmit? That doesn't work in this case. The reason should be clear. Why would it not work? Right. So, there is a playback time. Okay, if the data is not retransmitted and arrives by that time, is hopeless. If data comes later, the playback point has already gone by, so this is effectively useless. Now, if you have a very large buffer, can you see that data is missing? You can probably ask for retransmission, and that data may arrive before it's time to play it out. Okay, this is possible. But typically, buffers are not very large. They are reasonably small. They are designed to mask jitter, not to deal with losses. So if in this case, it's the retransmission is pointless, so you can't really do anything. Okay? So there are two techniques that are used to minimize the impact of losses or mitigate it altogether. So the first one shows how do you minimize the impact. This doesn't actually recover from losses, but it tries to minimize it by spreading the loss around. Okay? Here, what has happened is you have lost 4 packets in a row. So that has caused a big problem because there's a big glitch here. So instead, if you scramble the sending order, instead of sending in sequence 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, you scramble the order. So what you would do is you would send 1, and then the next packet, so the 4 frames you send in the first packet are not 1, 2, 3, 4, it's 1, 5, 9, 13, and then you send 2, 6, 10, 14, and so on. Yes? In other words, you take these 4 packets and you take the first frame of each, send that out as the first packet. Take the second frame of each, send that as the second packet, and so on. So in this case, what will happen is if this packet is lost, what is lost is frames 3, 7, 11, and 15. So this is spreading the losses out on the frame. So this may be less noticeable. Because if you are actually viewing, let's say, 10 frames or 30 frames a second, if in that 1 second, if one frame didn't show up, you probably will not notice. You only saw 29 frames in that. But to the human eye, this is not noticeable. Okay, but if you lose 15 frames, this is noticeable. You have a half second glitch. Okay, so what you have done is you have reduced the large glitch to several smaller glitches, which because of human tolerance to minor distortions in playback, you probably can get by. Okay, so by doing the scrambling, you can actually spread the losses rather than concentrating them into one position in the stream. This is one thing. The second thing that is typically done is to use redundancy. This is called forward error correction. So rather than just sending data, you actually send some additional bits, or not bits, but additional packets that allow you to recover any losses. Okay, so what you could do is, you could basically take the first, fifth, and the ninth frame, you XOR them and send this additional XOR information as a separate packet. Okay. So now if any one packet is lost, you can recover them from any of the other ones. There's a simple property of XOR, which basically says that, let's say A and B need to be sent. Okay? So you do an XOR and you construct C. So you send A, B, and C. Okay? If any one of this is lost, you can still reconstruct. So for example, if A is gone, okay, you can reconstruct A, but B and C were received. You basically do this and you get back A. Okay, this is what XOR does. And then if B is gone, you basically do A XOR C and get back B. If C is gone, you don't care. That's a parity bit because you only want A and B. Okay. So, but this increases the data rate at which you send because you're sending extra redundant information. The simplest redundancy is you send 2 copies of everything. Okay, that doubles your bit rate. That's a pretty high overhead. So rather than do that, you construct these parity bits, yeah, which is redundant information, and you send that at the stream. Okay, that allows you to reconstruct lost packets. And this is called forward error correction. Okay, so you're doing error. So this is also used for as error correcting codes and used in a wide variety of scenarios. Okay, not just media streaming. Is this clear? Okay. So the last thing that we will talk about as far as streams is concerned is synchronization. Okay, and this is also an important problem. And so let me just talk about what the problem is first. We may not have a picture here. So let me just, okay, so. So the where does the synchronization problem come? So when you typically send out a stream, okay, that has multiple components, not just one component. The simplest one is you have an audio component to the stream and a video component to the stream. Okay, so the audio is basically, an audio and video have to be synchronized in order for you to get good playback. Okay, the simplest form of synchronization is lip sync. Okay, when you see the video person in the video saying something, you want the audio to actually resemble what the person is saying. If they are out of sync, then the lips will move, but the words won't be heard on the speaker until some later point in time. Okay, and this doesn't give you pleasing playback quality. So you need to synchronize the audio and the video so that the audio, you want to display them out at the same point or in synchronous form in the way they were captured. Okay. How do you do this is the problem of stream synchronization. And why is this a problem to begin with is the other issue. Okay. So as is shown in this picture, okay, what this picture is showing is that the endpoint is capturing an audio and a video and is sending them as 2 independent streams over the network. Okay, so now you don't have one stream, but you have 2 streams coming, an audio stream and a video stream. And in order to play them out well, you have to synchronize the points between the audio and video. So in this frame and this audio sample have to be played together if you want them to be lip sync. Okay, so how do you do this is the problem of synchronization. And the way you do this is fairly simple. What you have to do is, let's suppose you have a camera and a microphone is connected to your PC. Okay, let's suppose you are doing video conferencing, okay, using Yahoo or whatever, some chat program. So this is capturing a video stream, this is capturing audio stream. To synchronize it, the first thing is you have to timestamp them so you know how when each was captured. So if you capture a frame and you capture an audio sample, you just timestamp them and they have the same timestamp that tells the receiver that they have to be played out together. Okay? So you have to have some way to associate information between these streams in order to synchronize. And the way you do this is through notion of timestamps. Okay? So assuming that you do have timestamps, now the endpoint has to synchronize. As the data is coming in, you try to map timestamps and you try to play out things with the same timestamps together. Okay? And this is how you will do synchronous playback. So what is shown here are two ways to do this. One is the application is actually processing the audio and video stream directly. It is looking at the timestamps and it's trying to figure out which data needs to be played out together and is doing it. And in the other case, you have a multimedia layer that is doing it for you. You just tell the layer saying, I have this these two streams coming in. This is 10 frames a second video and this is 128 kilobits per second stereo audio. Okay? Played back. Even stereo audio has two channels, a left channel and a right channel. If you don't play that together, you are in trouble. You'll get very bad audio playback. Okay, so you have to synchronize all of these streams. So in this case, the multimedia layer is going to do all of the work for you. Okay, this could be a multimedia codec, which will look for these timestamps and associate them and play it out. And this simplifies the application. Okay, the application is just telling the layer saying, this is the rate at which data is coming in, do the right thing. And in this other case, the application is doing it itself. Okay, now clearly, in most scenarios that you see, you have a library or the multimedia middleware that does it for you, if you write a multimedia application. Okay? So this is the problem of synchronization. Any question here? So the last thing I want to talk about is to go back to this. So everything until now has been one sender and one receiver. And this other picture I put up said that in webcast you have one sender, multiple receivers. And how do you do that? Okay, that's the other problem. So that's for that you need some notion of being able to send to multiple parties all at once. And typically this is done through group communication or multicasting. Okay? So there are various flavors of multicast. One is called IP multicast. And then the other one is application level multicast. Okay, so in IP multicast, the network actually supports group communication for you. Okay, so what happens here is you get an address that looks like an IP address. Okay, it is something 200 dot something dot something. It looks exactly like an IP address, but it's a special address. When you write to this address, there are multiple parties that the data will be delivered to, not just one. And this address does not actually resemble IP address of any one machine. It actually is a collection of machines that are collectively subscribing to this IP address. Okay? So from an application writer standpoint, communication still looks like vanilla socket communication. Okay, so in order to multicast data, you would just open a socket. It just so happens that the address you specify is a multicast address, not a IP address. And then you do the same thing and you just send on this socket. This is send socket, descriptor, buffer, and so on. And the network takes care of everything else. It figures out who should this packet be delivered to, which are the endpoints that are subscribed to this multicast channel, and so on and so forth. Okay? So this is nice from an application designer standpoint, right? Because the network is doing all of the hard work. You write your application exactly the same way. In fact, you can take any unicast or one-to-one application and turn it into a multicast application by simply changing the address. Okay, instead of specifying an IP address, you specify a multicast address. And then the application magically becomes multicast enabled. Okay? Now the problem with this approach is that it requires network support. Okay? In other words, again, you have to keep state at each router to figure out, if you think about, look at that tree that I showed you. So there is a multicast tree. So all of these nodes in the tree are routers. Okay. So each of them needs to know about this multicast address. They need to know which are the next hops, and there will be more than one hop because this is multicast, right? So you have to know when a packet arrives on this for this destination, who to send it to. Okay. All of that means you have to keep state in the routers. There's the same problem that I mentioned in the previous case with quality of service. Anytime you have to keep state in the routers, you have scalability issues. Okay, when you have tens of or hundreds of thousands of flows, if each flow is a multicast flow, you would have to keep a lot of state. Okay? And this is the reason, again, IP multicast is not used widely. Okay? In this case, it is actually implemented in the routers, but the ISPs don't turn it on. Okay? Because if you turn it on, then you have to deal with state problems. Okay, so the IP multicast, unlike quality of service, which was sort of more of a research project, IP multicast was actually standardized and implemented, and most routers that you buy today will support it, but very few have it turned on. Okay, so in other words, although this mechanism exists out there, not used. Okay, so this is out. From a real, if you wanted to actually do a multi-party communication, you really can't do IP multicast. So the only other option is to do what is called application level multicast, and this is just emulating IP multicast but at the application level. And this is shown in this picture here. So what happens here is there are application level endpoints. So if you want to construct this tree, rather than putting support in the routers, what you do is you still construct a multicast tree of this fashion. This is the source, and these are the receivers or the sinks. Okay, it just so happens that these nodes that are in the tree are not routers, but they are application gateways. Okay, so in this case, the source is going to contact two processes that run on two machines and say, here is a data that's coming to me. Okay, and these two processes contact two other processes that run on some other machines and just forward data that way until it reaches the sinks. Okay. So these are processes. So you have basically each of this is a unicast TCP or UDP flow, and then you forward along two more, and these are application level gateways as opposed to network routers. So you could set up a network like this. Okay, in this case, think of these as all proxies that are sitting or distributed everywhere in your network. Okay, so if you have lots of these proxy servers out there, then you can do multicast or emulate multicast at the application level. Okay, this is not native multicast, but it's application level multicast. And this people have done. Yes, you have a question there.
Yeah, you mentioned MPI. You said that they sometimes implement sidestepping basically the entire network stack.
Right.
So how do they implement multicast?
Okay, good question. So question is, since I said IP multicast not in use, okay, how does MPI support multicast? Because I said it actually has this primitive to send to a group, not to one. Very good point. Any thoughts? What they do? Right. So the point is, the point that was raised is exactly what is the answer is, MPI applications are designed for LANs, meaning a cluster of servers that's connected by Ethernet switch. Okay, this kind of communication goes over a wide area or over the WAN, meaning there's the internet sitting in between the server. So if whenever you have a WAN, you need support in the router. If you're on a local area network, everything just is enabled through switches. So switches by default support multicast. In fact, switches support broadcast. I said that if you want to broadcast to all machines on the LAN, we just send to 255.255.255.2. This is how DHCP works, right? So you boot up your machine, it just broadcasts a message saying, is there a DHCP server out there? And then some DHCP server responds. So it's much simpler to support broadcast in a LAN. It's already enabled. Okay, since that is the case, MPI just uses that support for free. It doesn't have to do it. It will not work if machines that do MPI communication are separated by a router anywhere in between. Because if the router doesn't support multicast, you are not going to work. Okay, so that's the answer. It only works in a very restricted setting, and in the which is a LAN setting, and in that setting broadcast is already supported. So you can emulate multicast as broadcast. Okay. Yes, question there.
Aren't there problems with sending a lot of data over broadcast?
Yes, aren't there problems sending broadcast? Absolutely. You don't want to broadcast a lot of data. But the, again, MPI settings are one where you have this large simulation cluster sitting in a dark room somewhere, and there is a switch, a gigabit switch that connects them. So you're only broadcasting in that switch. I mean, it's not going to go out and flood your entire LAN. Yeah, you do that. Okay, so you'll get a subnet of its own and only broadcast on that subnet, not over your entire LAN for the organization. Any questions here? Okay. So I think this is where we will end this chapter. Okay, so the next slide is actually chapter 4, which I'll start next time because we are effectively run out of time. Okay. All right, so let's stop here.